This podcast is brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Lectures, radio shows, and more on demand at sevillepodcast.com. How can you tell whether a book will be a good selection for your reading group? Three popular authors tell what makes for a good group read. Listen in as James Collins, Jill A. Davis, and Therese Fowler discuss reading group choices with moderator Barbara Mead.
And all these great authors, they not only have written great books, but they've written great book club books. James Collins, and he wrote, look up there, Beginner's Greek, was born in Manhattan and lives in Virginia with his family. He writes for the New Yorker and has been an editor at both Time and Spy magazine, and also was a Little Brown editorial assistant. He lives in Virginia with his family. Beginner's Greek is a brilliant, understated comedy of manners in which love lost is found again. Book Page reviews Beginner's Greek and the book's author's style, stating, Collins writes with spare, graceful style, and Peter Russell, his main character, exudes an earnest, everyman appeal that will make many a reader wish he could spring out from the pages. Beginner's Greek is one of those books that both perfectly satisfies and leaves you wanting more. Therese Fowler holds an MFA in creative writing from NC State. Therese Fowler grew up in Illinois and now lives in Raleigh, North Carolina, with her husband and two sons. Souvenir, Therese's first novel, is a heartbreaking story of a woman who made what she thought was a responsible decision, only to live with the consequences. New York Times best-selling author Luann Rice writes, Souvenir is tender, touching, and completely compelling. I cared so much about these characters. Couldn't put down the novel, read through the night. Therese Fowler writes with such wisdom about young love, intense and impossible choices, and the way one decision can affect an entire life. Jill A. Davis, she has Ask Again Lately.
Ask Again Later.
Yep. Thank you. Jill was a writer for a late show for David Letterman, where she received 5 Emmy nominations. Her first novel was Girls Poker Night. She has also written several television pilots and movie screenplays, in addition to some short stories. She lives in New York City with her husband and daughter. Ask Again Later is a laugh-out-loud tale that confirms that you can recover from your parents, the bad habits of missed opportunities, and men who romance you. Kirkus Reviews writes about Jill and Ask Again Later. From the author of Girls Poker Night, another light comedy with a dash of neurosis, Davis makes the narrative work with effortless light humor and genuine thoughtfulness. Also, she has well-drawn characters with emotional integrity. And so I'd like to have the authors maybe do a little summary of their work and do a little bit of reading. And then after the Q&A with the audience, maybe they can also tell us about what they're working on now or a new novel or something like that. So James?
Is this on?
Yes.
Thank you, Barbara. And I'd like to just thank the Virginia Festival for the book for inviting me, and it's a great honor, and it's a wonderful week. I live about half an hour north of here, and this is an amazing event, so I'm very grateful to be here, and thank you to Gravity Lounge, too. And finally, thank you to all of you for coming, because I don't know how these other writers, what their experience has been, but sometimes these things are not... Sometimes they're mostly your family, and one or two people have wandered in off the street, and so it's great to see a lot of people here who are enthusiastic. My publicist would want me to say that the book is a New York Times bestseller and also a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, so I will get that out. It is set in New York. It starts with a man and a woman, a young man and woman, who meet on an airplane, and fall in love. They meet. One of the things that they have a connection with is that the woman is reading The Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann. And it's a book that the man likes very much, and also it's a book that he thinks he's sitting there trying to judge whether he has the courage to talk to this person because she's very pretty and she seems wonderful, and he's trying to think of an excuse not to talk to her, and he's thinking about all the various kinds of books she could be reading, a book about angels or a book about, you know, that would be make him say to himself, well, she wouldn't be interesting to me, I don't have to talk to her, but actually this book is a very profound and interesting one, so he can't tell himself there's no reason he has to force himself to overcome his fear and actually talk to her. They fall in love on the plane, then their things happen, and we rejoin, they don't end up being together, we rejoin them a few years later when they're both with other people. And let's see, Peter DeCuro works for a very prestigious investment bank in New York. There's another character, his ultimate wife is a woman named Charlotte. As Holly is the woman he meets on the plane. There's also his best friend, Jonathan, who's a writer. Other characters are Peter's boss. There's a Wall Street subplot to it, and Peter's boss and the guy who owns the investment house, Charlotte's father and stepmother also play a role, and also Holly's father. So those are sort of the main characters, and it has a complicated plot, and it's supposed to be funny and charming and that stuff like that, and also have it's a sort of satirical and a fairy tale, and also have its serious literary bits also. I like my blurbs very much, and so I like very much with Kathleen Shine, the novelist, who I do not know, who but nicely read it and really loved it, said is James Collins is a skeptic, a realist, and a fervent romantic all in one. And I try to keep skepticism and realism and fervent romance all in balance in the book. It was fun to write, actually, it's been a good experience so far. So maybe I will just read a little bit. I actually usually just read from the beginning because it has a complicated plot and I hate to ruin things, but at one reading someone specifically asked that I read a particular passage, which is not very long, and I will actually read from the middle of it this time around. Just to give you all the, you don't need that much background. This woman who said, oh, it's so romantic, it's so wonderful, so touching, so you have to read it when you do this reading that she was going to be at. So I agreed, despite the fact it's a little bit on the, it's not the skeptic realistic part, it's more the fervent romantic part. Peter and his wife Charlotte are in their apartment, and Holly, who is the woman who Peter fell in love with on the plane, has come to cook dinner for them, and Charlotte is going to Paris the next day, so she's come to help her out and cook dinner. And this is after dinner. They've had some wine to drink, and what Holly says. The dinner ended up being pretty good. Holly had made a dish of thinly sliced potatoes and cream that qualified as delicious. The conversation flowed along happily, led by an unusually vivacious Charlotte. They drank a fair amount of wine. The three of them were eating a flourless chocolate cake and drinking some more wine when Holly lightly tapped on her glass with a fork. "I'd like to propose a toast," she said. Peter and Charlotte looked at Holly and at each other and back at Holly. "I didn't give a toast at your dinner," that's the dinner before the wedding, that Charlotte and Peter are married, I think I said that. "I didn't give a toast at your dinner, so I'd like to do it now. A toast to you and your love for each other." She took a deep breath. "As you may know, various people over the years have spoken and written on the topic of love. Some of the writers whom I would teach to my students if they were advanced enough, which they aren't, wrote of it very eloquently and sometimes very coarsely." She teaches Latin at a girls' private school. "So I doubt I will say anything original or profound or even very coherent, but I am inspired by this company to say something. Let's see. Well, first of all, let me say I have the utmost respect for the Buddha. I think he thought thoughts in 500 BC that were truly excellent. Now, Buddha promulgated the Four Noble Truths, and let me refresh your memory about what they are. All existence is suffering, the cause of all suffering is desire, freedom from suffering is nirvana, and nirvana is attained through the eightfold path of ethical conduct, wisdom, and mental discipline. Not having founded a religion that has had millions upon millions of adherents over the past 2,500 years, I am hardly in a position to criticize. But I personally don't accept the validity of all four of the Noble Truths. I don't know if all existence is suffering. Most cats aren't suffering, as far as I can tell. People at a movie that they really like aren't suffering. But the second Noble Truth is definitely true to my mind. All suffering does come from desire, definitely. Number three, absolutely, totally. The extinction of self, that desiring self, leads to freedom. And as to the last one, yes, sure, the Eightfold Path. I'm all for it, 100%. But, and again, who am I to judge? I don't think that is the only way. I think you can also escape suffering through love. When you really love someone and they really love you, you have desire, but not in the sense of wanting things that you can't get or shouldn't want in the first place. It's not even that your desire has been satisfied. It's not satiety. You lie in that person's arms, you aren't thinking about what's next or what's wrong or what you want. You aren't trying to get someplace. Rather than doing, approving, or striving for something, you just sort of are, as a lyric poem, a work of art is supposed to be, or like a big boulder that's really just there. And again, it's not that you've gotten what you desire or and so are satisfied, it's that there's no doingness or provingness or strivingness. To my mind, this sounds a little like nirvana, and I'd say you are emptied of yourself. The difference, maybe, is that in my scheme, you aren't just emptied, you are also filled, but filled with one big thing that replaces all the 10 million nettlesome, egotistical things that are inside you as a rule. And with that one thing comes a feeling of joy, not no feeling. You're like a big boulder that somehow has levitated 6 feet off the ground. Then there's one more thing, which is wanting to make the other person happy, to give yourself to him or her. But this wanting is not a feeling external to love or the result of any incompleteness. It is one component of that big single thing. And serving the person you love isn't something you do, in quotes. It's entirely natural. It's guided by the same part of your brain, whichever it is, that controls your heartbeat and your kidney function or whatever. If you love someone, then you feel that about them the way I've described. If that person shares that feeling and you are together, then that is the happiest, the highest state of being and the happiest. Holly was about to cry. She swallowed and then laughed a little in embarrassment. She looked at Peter and Charlotte. So, you two, nice going. She let out a combined laugh and sob. Here's to you, and remember, neither of you can drink.
Well, I would like to repeat much of what James said. Thank you for being here. Thank Barbara for organizing this for us. And I appreciate the festival folks inviting me to take part in this. I am a brand new author. When I knew that I was going to be on this panel with Jill and James, it was a little bit intimidating for me because Jill's got a background writing for the David Letterman Show and all the wonderful accomplishments that Barbara described. And James has been involved in many lofty endeavors and a lot of hard work in his writing career and editorial career. And who am I? You know, I've never published anything in my life before this novel. I kind of have a little bit of a Cinderella story with this book, although certainly not an overnight success. I was an aspiring novelist for many years before I wrote the manuscript that became Souvenir. I had two failed attempts before this book. And really, when I turned the manuscript over to my agent, I had no expectations because the manuscript that I had given her previously, which was the book that she signed me on for, was on submission to some wonderful editors, and we were getting some wonderful rejections. And I really had no expectations at that point because you think when you get a literary agent to agree to represent you in the first place, that's the golden ticket, which turned out not to necessarily be the case for me. So I was determined that I would write something that was publishable. And I spent about 7 months on this manuscript, and I, you know, worked on it assiduously while I was working part-time at a literary journal as an editorial assistant. And I gave it to my agent, and she didn't read it right away. She was going college shopping with her daughter. And so I didn't know this up front. And weeks passed, and I thought, oh, God, she hates it. You know, she's gonna kick me to the curb, and, you know, I'm going to have to get a real job. She started reading the manuscript. She emailed me the next morning saying, I really love what you're doing here. I'm going to need a few more days, and then we'll talk. And then the next day, she emailed me, and she said, I finished it at 2 a.m. You know, I'm going to call you later. I think this is a good thing. And within 4 days, the book was sold in some territories overseas, and the auction was beginning for the sale here in the United States. So I went from, you know, feeling like an abject failure to feeling like a tremendous success. And in short order, I think we had sales in 11 countries for the book. So that was an auspicious start, and makes me feel a little bit more like I'm, you know, belong on this panel. I have a master's in fine arts in creative writing, and prior to taking the writing instruction there, I had not had any writing classes, and I studied sociology for my BA degree, so I really didn't have a background in literature at all, save for what I had studied in high school. And so the MFA program is an immersion in the writing craft, but it's also an immersion in the study of literature. And so I was on this enormously tight learning curve. You know, what is literature really? I'd grown up reading popular fiction. You know, I read Stephen King, I read, you know, Judith Krantz, I read John Grisham. I didn't really know literature other than that usual, you know blue bloods read literature, and the literati and the elites, but not regular folks like me who grew up, you know, in very, very humble beginnings in the Midwest. What I discovered was that, you know, literature is great, and I was really excited about so many of the things that I was learning. And one of the things that most impressed me about the books that I was reading and loving was that at the heart of those books was usually, or at least of the books that I responded to most, was a moral question. When I read Lolita, for example, I was blown away by how I found the character both abhorrent and compelling at the same time, and I thought, this is a remarkable feat and a very interesting story. You know, people don't always choose well, and when they don't choose well, there are always consequences. And so when I was writing Souvenir, that's what I was trying to get at. One decision made by a young woman who thinks she's doing the right thing for the right reasons comes back to haunt her in a number of ways. And so I'm going to read a little bit from the opening of the book just to sort of demonstrate how right off the bat we understand that this is not necessarily admirable behavior on the part of the main character. And then the rest of the story after the prologue takes place in contemporary times where we visit the consequences that have come 16 years later from these actions. The prologue is set in August of 1989, and the setting is Central Florida, and our protagonist here is, her name is Meg, and she's 21 at this time. Oh, I should also say, she comes from a sort of working class rural background in Central Florida. Her family owns a horse farm. It's not a very successful endeavor, and she has grown up, you know, sort of really dirt poor and kind of the subject of derision of people in the community. People feel sorry for her family. What she was doing was wrong, but then everything was wrong, wasn't it? She was sneaking out to see Carson, even though in 13 hours she'd be another man's wife. Brian's wife. Brian's wife. No matter how she phrased the words, they hardly made sense to her even now. They belonged to someone else's reality. It was as if she, Meg Powell, would cease to exist at the end of the wedding ceremony becoming some unfamiliar woman called Mrs. Bryan Hamilton. But maybe it was better that way. She left her house in the dark and traced the familiar path through the pastures toward the lake and the groves and Carson's house. The sun would rise before much longer, and her sisters would wake, excited. Meg's wedding day! Her parents would find her note saying she'd gone for a walk and wouldn't be concerned. They'd know she'd be back in plenty of time. She was nothing if not reliable and responsible, a model daughter, their deliverance. And she was glad to be those things, if only she could shut down the Meg who still longed for the future she'd sacrificed. This visit to Carson was meant to do that, to shut it down. This part of her mission was appropriate, at least. This was the part she would explain to him. If she knew Carson, and after 16 years of best friendship, she knew only herself better, he would accept the partial truth without suspecting there was anything more to it. She wanted so much to tell him the truth about the rest, to explain why she was marrying Brian, but besides jeopardizing everything, it would make him want to try to fix things. And if that had been possible, there would not now be a breathtaking $4,000 wedding gown waiting in her room like a fairy tale in progress. The thought of it hanging from her closet door, specter-like, made her shudder. She'd read enough fairy tales to know they didn't always end happily. Carson lived in a converted shed on his parents' Florida citrus farm. The McKay farm adjoined her family's horse farm, sharing an east-west line of wood posts and barbed wire. The fence kept the horses out of the groves, but had never been a serious obstacle for Meg or her three younger sisters, or Carson. When she was 7 or 8 years old, they'd found a wooden ladder and sawed it in half, then propped the halves on opposite sides of a post to make their passage easy. Meg wasn't surprised now to see the ladder gone. Climbing the barbed wire, she took care not to get a cut she'd be hard-pressed to explain tonight. 15 minutes later, she emerged from the shadows of the orange grove and stopped. In the light of the setting moon, she could see the shed, its white clapboard siding and dark windows, 100 yards to the left of the main house. She and Carson had spent most of his senior year working with his father to renovate it, creating 2 downstairs rooms and an upstairs bedroom loft. They'd called the shed their love nest, not only because they first made love there, but also because they meant for it to become their home. Not for always, just for starters. The plan had been to eventually build a new house on the far side of his farm, on the wooded hillside where, as children, they'd hung a tire swing for themselves and her sisters, where, years later, they had spread an old horse blanket and gone as far as they'd dared without protection. This morning, she was purposely, some might say selfishly, no better prepared.
Thank you for being here today. It's very nice to be in Charlottesville with so many book lovers. This is my first visit, and it's always nice to be in a group with people who not only buy books but read them. Following up on something James said earlier, can you just raise your hand if you are a member of my family? Yeah. I have a sister who lives here. I live in New York City, so my sister is here. With her husband and her 3 children, and my husband and my daughter are also here. I thought I would talk a little bit about my trajectory as a writer. I've written for newspapers, television, and eventually novels, and frequently when I do these events, the questions that follow are largely about how I got from there to here. So I thought I would talk a little bit about that and then do a reading. I've been writing professionally for over 20 years, and I started out writing columns for a small newspaper on the North Shore of Boston. And I was writing a first-person column, so I would go out and do things like spend the day working on a garbage truck, or I'd go to palm readers and have discussions about my love life, and then I would compare the different palm readers' readings and write a column. I would seek out interesting people. I once met a woman who dressed her pet llamas as Star Trek characters. And so the things I was doing in my little column were things I thought would translate well to pieces on the Letterman show. And I started sending my columns into the show in 1990, which Letterman was an incredibly hot show at the time. It was on the NBC network. And about 6 months later, they offered me a job on the show doing the sorts of things that I was already doing in my column. And I went on to spend 6 years writing top 10 lists, viewer mail responses, opening remarks, and doing short video remotes. And the remotes included Dave and a psychic competing to predict expiration dates on dairy products at local delis, Dave and Zsa Zsa Gabor eating fast food at drive-through restaurants in Los Angeles, and Dave and Carol Channing playing ping pong, all the while Carol saying to me, "Why is this funny again?" And I couldn't really explain it to her. But after writing in a guy's voice for about 6 years, I grew restless to write in my own voice. And at that point, I started writing short stories while I was still at the show. And I got very lucky in that I was able to sell some to HBO, and they were going to produce them as a series of monologues. But up until that point, I had never written anything longer than a newspaper column, which is about 18 inches of copy, 18 to 23. And then top 10 lists, which are quite short, and you learn to write very brief when you're writing for television. And so my 30-page stories were the longest things that I had ever written, and that really gave me the confidence to try to go off and write a novel, which is something I had dreamed of doing since the time I was a kid. I got a little sidetracked, and when I left the show, I ended up getting a development deal with ABC, and I wrote a couple of sitcom pilots. And one of them was a show called Anna Says, and it was picked up by Steven Spielberg and Michael J. Fox, and Tracy Pollan starred in it. You never saw it because it never got picked up as a series. But they spent $2 million producing and filming the pilot, and which is a lovely resume for me, the world's most expensive resume. From the time I wrote the script until it was produced, I had rewritten the script over 20 times. And this was a very different experience for me because I was used to the immediacy of newspapers, the immediacy of television. You write something in the afternoon, you see it in the newspaper the next day, or you see it on television that night. So 2 years of development felt like a very, very long time. But at that point, I was hired to be the creator, head writer, and executive producer of that series that ultimately did not get picked up. And I was 15 years into my career. I was 33 years old. And I realized that if I didn't reallocate my time, I would never have a family. So it was at that point I really kind of threw myself into novel writing. And 2 years later, Girls Poker Night made the New York Times bestseller list, and I was described as first-time writer Jill Davis. My novels focus on comedic realism, and I need the subtlety of tension and drama that play out in real life to make the comedy and the characters work. And in the case of my first novel, Girls Poker Night, a weekly poker game is used as a metaphor for the risks that the characters take and in order to grow up. And a woman, Ruby Capote, is abandoned by her father as a child, and as an adult, she falls for a guy who has abandoned his child. That created the real-life drama of how this doomed love can never be resolved. And even after writing, after I knew what the story was going to be and I found the logical source of drama, it took me months of not writing to figure out how I could resolve the story. So for me, you know, a lot of time spent writing, I'd say 50% of my time is spent writing when I'm working on something. The other 50% is just spent thinking about what's going to happen, how it needs to happen, before I even sit down to write it. My second novel, Ask Again Later, was published in 2007, and the paperback just came out about 8 weeks ago, I guess. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Russo calls it serious and emotionally resonant, and it rewards at every level. And I don't know him either, so. In this book, I explore work as a replacement for love and the office culture as a replacement for family. Emily Rode is a young lawyer whose world is turned upside down when her mother is diagnosed with an illness, and she moves back into her childhood home to help her mother. But because I write comedy, the illness is very curable. Emily's father, who left when she was 5, reappears, and underneath, this is a story about divorce and how a child copes with the irrational loss of a parent. My aim is always to write something bittersweet, empathetic, and funny, handle serious, realistic material, but with humor. And James mentioned his publicist would be upset if he didn't mention that his book was on the New York Times bestseller list. I think you have a better publicist than I do. She probably isn't even aware where I am right now. But in any event, the hardcover of Ask Again Later debuted on the New York Times bestseller list, and this version, the paperback, was on the New York Times bestseller list last week. So I'm going to read a little bit from this book, very short chapters, and I'll introduce them briefly and read for a few minutes. At this point, when we meet Emily, her mother's just been diagnosed, and she's just found a lump, and everything else becomes secondary in Emily's life, and she immediately starts to feel left out at work when she shows up a little bit late, because this is a person who's extremely reliable, always does the right thing, and for her, the first time in her life, she's going to become irresponsible. This chapter is called Instant Coffee. I walk into the conference room. Gray suits, white shirts, raised eyebrows, and unhappy looks in my direction. I take a seat. I mouth the word, sorry, to everyone who will look, though some people don't look. They are too incensed that I have the gall to show up late when they've been in this cavernous chamber all morning. When I first became a lawyer, I loved the extreme detail of it, how language mattered, the way it required my full attention, and how, unlike my family, it was explicit in its meaning. I'd found the demanding job that needed me as much as I needed it. It was a dream come true. With time, you'd think too much of a good thing can only get better. But in my case, it's become suffocating. It's devoured all other parts of my life. I couldn't have said this yesterday. I couldn't have admitted it. Or maybe it was not true yesterday. I mouth the word coffee to Jenny, the assistant. I know what you're thinking. Fetch your own coffee, lady. How sexist to expect young and spry Jenny to get coffee. It's the other way around, of course. Jenny gets coffee only for men. In law school, I didn't imagine this would be one of my more difficult precedent-setting arguments. Jenny's paid to be a floater. That means seamlessly filling the gaps, floating from one task to the other, without interrupting the flow of work or ideas. Jenny pretends she doesn't see me. Instead of aiming to be helpful and largely invisible, she pretends I am invisible. I wait until we make eye contact, then I make a pouring motion. Still, I get the freeze. Jenny looks away from me quickly and begins removing imaginary lint from her skirt. I wait. I pounce again. I mouth the word coffee, then make a pouring motion followed by a sipping, oops, too hot, don't sip too fast motion. Jen, I start to say. Jenny, can you stop pretending you don't see Emily and get the goddamn coffee so she can quit it with the pantomime routine, Donald says. For the life of me, I'll never understand how the hell being paid to pour coffee landed on par with abuse. Donald is a man who does not wait for life and does not waste time on pleasantries. Donald is a doer. He gets shit done. It must be so satisfying to be Donald. I can already predict what form the ugly retaliation will take. Scalding hot, instant decaf with non-dairy creamer. I miss my home. I wish it were yesterday instead of today, and too often that is my wish. I'm going to read a bit more from... This chapter is called My Shrink. So when Emily's world starts to crash around her, she starts seeing a therapist, and she's sort of suspicious of the whole therapeutic process. She's not quite ready to work things out. My Shrink. Paul's office is cozy, and by cozy, I mean there is a white wicker daybed in lieu of a couch. The first time I came to see him, there were pastel-colored butterfly sheets on the daybed, and I almost didn't come back because of that single detail. I tortured myself with what it could all mean, his butterfly sheets. Are we all meant to soar in this world? To see things from the vantage point of a metamorphosizing insect? Or were they just sheets that happened to fit the daybed? As soon as he gets an actual couch, I'll be lying on it. Until then, I'll sit in silence across from him in the black foam-stuffed pleather club chair. So, what's happening in your internal life, Paul asks. Who's got time for an internal life, I say. Not a hell of a lot happening in your conscious life, Paul says. Ouch, I say. Well, not anything you're willing to talk about, Paul says. I steal a glance at him. He needs a haircut. Like all shrinks, he wants me to talk about my mother. Whatever happened to that guy, I ask, the one who had the appointment after me? Why do you ask? Paul says. I think I miss him, I say. I can't handle separations that aren't accompanied by lots of advance notice. I see, Paul says. You cured him, and I'm not sure I'll be able to forgive you, I say. Because you miss him, or because I cured him and not you? Paul asks. You're good, and feisty too, I say. But either way, you're in the wrong, and I'm not forgiving you. He laughs. His eyes go from happy to sad on a dime. He's mastered empathy. I used to like that ratty backpack he carried, even though he was too old to carry a backpack, in my opinion. And then, just before he stopped seeing you, he switched to a leather briefcase. No scuffs, brand new. I should have taken that as a sign, I say. Sign of what? Paul asks. That he was ready to move on, that he'd grown up or something, I say. It's about being grown up, Paul asks. Ask again later, I say. It's my favorite non-answer. Then I shrug, I wait. I have no idea what it's about, but I return week after week in hopes of finding out. There's no such thing as grown up, Paul says. Well, that's encouraging, I say. If you really think about it, Paul says, it is encouraging. I stare at the trees in the park. There is ice on the branches. I can see the skeletons of old birds' nests. Every so often, the branches catch the wind like a kite, a visual lullaby. Some ice falls. Then I imagine the cost of pruning those trees. That always breaks the spell. Must be absolutely astronomical. I'm going to read one more very brief one. This one is called The Baby. And in this chapter, Emily's sister has just had a baby. And seeing her nephew for the first time has given Emily great optimism. It's called Baby. Little Malcolm has the most perfect little round head and big blue eyes, the tiniest feet and fingers. They seem too tiny to function. His lips and skin are red, and his hair is jet black. He looks like a skinny, wet kitten. I can't help but stare in amazement at the only 7 pounds that could ever truly change Marjorie's world. They weigh him and measure him and roll his feet on an ink pad. What a clumsy introduction to the world. I get to hold him while Marjorie is being taken care of. He looks at me. He's studying me, staring at my enlarged pores. I turn my head. He keeps looking, the unrelenting observer. I whisper in his ear, confiding. I've tried facials. I've tried minimizers. Nothing works. He smiles. He knows stuff. He burps, and in that burp, I'm convinced, was a message. Try alpha hydroxy. Thank you.
Going down the line, did you work in your father's office? You know, things like that.
Well, the initial incident in the book actually really did happen to me. I was on a plane going from New York to Los Angeles. I was about 23 years old, and I was sitting there, and a very beautiful young woman came and sat down next to me, and she was reading The Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann. Now, it's a little different from what happens in the book because, first of all, I knew her slightly, so it wasn't the same kind of love at first sight thing. The next 400 pages did not happen between her and me. And also, one of the things that the hero says in the book is that looks over and she's on page 600 of The Magic Mountain, which she's, oh boy, she's really reading it. She's not just got it. And, she's obviously was very smart and interesting because she's already on page 600. And this girl was sort of on page 12, which kind of made her not quite make the cut in my mind. But so that actually was something that actually happened. And it was fun to use that actual incident. But if it had been a different book, I wouldn't have, because that book does mean something to me and it plays a role in the themes of my book, too. So it was sort of a funny coincidence of a real incident, which also could be used for some meaning as well. But that is back. This is literally the only thing in the whole book that is anything autobiographical at all. I mean, I worked on Wall Street. The world obviously is someplace I know, but the characters and the incidents are all completely, totally made up to an extent that actually even amazes me because I don't quite know where some of it came from. But nothing is taken from my life. And none of the characters are people I know. And so it really is 97% imagination.
Except for that one little thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much what James said, except, I wasn't on a plane and I haven't read Magic Mountain. No, really, similarly, nothing in this book is truly autobiographical, but, you know, sort of the genesis of the idea or the theme that when we are youthful, we make decisions that affect us later is something that is very personal to me. I got married the first time at age 18, thinking that I really, you know, had everything all figured out. And so, you know, this is something that I kind of continue to work out in my own life all the time. I got married, I stayed married for a dozen years. I realized that this was not a good decision on my part. You know, with each passing year, the fact that it was a bad decision became clearer and clearer. So although there is no single character here that represents anyone I know, and the situations are, thank goodness, more dramatic than anything that has occurred in my life, I do draw from that sort of initial sort of universal stupidity of young women in particular, but really young people in general, and how sort of unfortunate it is that sometimes we don't receive the wisdom that we need from people around us to help us make better decisions. I think I'm doing a better job of it now.
I would say I think all fiction is autobiographical, but not in this specific way.
Yeah,
I think it's all psychologically autobiographical, masked in stories that are not as obvious because, you know, a book obviously needs a neat beginning, middle, end, whereas life doesn't work that way. But in terms of both of my books, I'd say the first one is more autobiographical in the sense that the character was a columnist, which I was a columnist, worked in a newsroom with a lot of old men, which I worked in a newsroom with a lot of old men, you know, eventually moved to New York, which I moved to New York, all those things. And in the case of Ask Again Later, the specifics are not autobiographical at all, but of course the underlying stories in each case are. There's one story that I did use in my first book, Girls Poker Night, that is one of those, you know, truth is stranger than fiction sort of things. I started working as a reporter when I was about 20. I was going to Emerson College at the time, studying journalism, and I was writing this cooking column called The Wooden Spoon, and I would go out into the community and interview a nice woman and put her six favorite recipes in and write a little feature. So it was my first or second week on the job. I'm in this woman's house, and at the end of the interview, I ask her if she has anything else to say, and I'm scribbling my notes. I look up, and she had died of a heart attack. And so, you know, it's the kind of thing you say, well, geez, is this going to be happening all the time? Maybe I need to come up with a new set of questions. But so that actually is in my first book because, you know, why shouldn't it be? It should be.
I tend to sort of analyze excessively up front, try to think it through, try to make notes. I don't really have a plot outlined. I sort of have a situation, and I know it's going to start more or less with these people, and it's going to end more or less this way, but what happens in the middle I sort of have to discover as I'm going through the writing process. So I will start several times, many times, sometimes hundreds of pages before I've figured out where the right place is. And then once I've got that, I can write straight through from there.
Yeah, I'd say that for me, I had a rough idea of sort of big, you know, A and B and C events, but getting between them, I actually was really amazed how many things and even characters arose simply because I was riding along and someone mentioned somebody, the stepmother here, that someone just, she mentions her stepmother. And that actually became an entire character, which was not part of the original plan. So it was really a rough idea of where things were going to end up, but a whole lot was just stuff I would never have been able to think of ahead of time, but came up just as I was going along. And that actually another thing that surprised me, I didn't know that would happen quite as often in quite as significant ways as it did.
I would add one thing to that, which I think my books, whenever I've written an outline, the first part's always the same at the end. The second part's always the same. In each case, the ending has always sort of evolved, and the characters do start to, it sounds a little goofy, take over at some point. And you start to write things, and you say, oh, that character would never say that. That really sounds more like something someone else would say. So they really do kind of start to drive the story toward the end, I find. I don't know if that's, if you all feel the same.
I was at listening to James speak last night at the New Dominion Bookshop, and I was sitting on the stairs, and they were in a loft area upstairs speaking, and as the discussion was taking place, I had opening lines just for my next novel, just ding, you know. So I took my notebook and I'm scribbling down, you know, the dialogue that, you know, characters who I'm already sort of familiar with. What they're going to say when I start writing that next novel. So it does happen. It sounds like, you know, you're an observer too. You know, you'll see somebody and you'll just imagine what must that person be like. And even if you don't have very much to go on, just enough what they're wearing, how they're standing, what they're eating, whether they're picking their nose, whatever's going on, you know, you make up something, a story that fits what you have seen. I mean, Jill's obviously got a lot of real anecdotes to draw from, but I find that happens, you know, frequently, probably more than I would like because it's distracting at times.
I'd just say that I'd have lots of scraps of paper that I think of something more to do with the book, though, specifically of a line or a solution to something, and I would be someplace or where I wouldn't have the right stuff to write down, and I would scrawl it on something, the back of the paperback I'm reading, or, if I'm in an airport, something like that. But the only thing really like that for me is that I found when I was writing it, I thought I would go around my life thinking, I wouldn't write it down, but I'd think, oh man, look at that curtain blowing in the light in this room. That would be good. That would be good to use. And I actually found I was working 24 hours a day because I would sort of, in my mind, now that I'm a novelist and a fiction writer, which I had not been, I was much more conscious of sort of, just in my memory though, culling and remembering things. Oh yeah, that's good. I could use that. That's another thing. Oh yeah, that's. And it was sort of made life a little bit. Don't do it so much anymore. I was right in the middle of it. It was. I kept on thinking this is not the way to live. It's just to be going around and think, yeah, okay, that's something. You know. Oh good. And instead of just being, you know, just living. So in that sense, I was doing something similar.
I take notes often, but probably not as often as I used to, and then they all kind of end up in a box on my desk, and I eventually put them on index cards, and not necessarily for what I'm working on now, but if something comes up. There was one card I had that said, Leather Coat Christmas, and to me, I know exactly what that means. It's a gift that you get for someone when you've been dating for a while, but you don't really know them that well, but you want to get them something kind of big and nice. So Leather Coat Christmas, that's what that meant to me. So sometimes I just jot down a few words, and eventually, you know, there's a whole backstory behind that comes with that note.
Walk out of that prison, you know? In my mind, before I
He was asking, you know, writers can do lots of different things, write on cereal boxes or write for TV, I guess he was asking, you know, is being a novelist really the best way to be a writer, the most? And I was in journalism. I worked on Wall Street, and then I was in journalism for a fairly long time. A lot of pressure. And I was actually never a fast writer in college, and I was always sort of a procrastinator, and I would have a difficult time getting started, and I was sort of one of those people who agonized a bit. And when you have these serious deadlines, that can be problematic. And, you know, you always have to get the thing done, but it was always sort of stressful. Writing this, I found to be actually incredibly fun, more fun. It was never agony. I never had to force myself. I don't think I could have done it if I had suffered while doing it, because it was uncertain whether it would be something that would work out. So the fact that it was fun, I was really enjoying it, certainly made it more easy to keep on going. As I've said before, in journalism, well, it's nice to be able to make stuff up and not feel bad about it. Whereas, you know, in journalism, you kind of, you feel sort of feel, you know, a little guilty. I did find making stuff up actually really fun, and not being bound by facts, and having to, you know, oh my God, is the guy's tie, literally, is the guy's tie red or green? Having that freedom was really great. I know people who are creative writers who love to do journalism because they don't have to make it up, because, oh my God, thank God, the world is giving me stuff to work from. I don't have to have it all come out of my head. So, but it was a nice change. But anyway, I really, really enjoy doing it. And so for me, it was the most fun writing I'd ever done.
Yes, the answer is yes.
I don't have prior experience, you know, as a writer professionally, but I always imagined that if I did write professionally, it would not be fiction. I came to writing fiction rather late in sort of the process of my psyche as, you know, a writer. I thought I might write for Parenting Magazine because I had young children, or I might write, you know, for, I don't know, you know, pick anything that's not fiction. Fiction is the hardest job to do until you've done it, and then it gets to be a much simpler thing, especially if your book is succeeding. I'll tell you what, I wouldn't do anything else now, but it's easy to say that now. I agree with James. I mean, it's a joy. I'm excited to get up and sit down at the computer and make things up, you know, for most of the day. I can't think of a better job.
Yes, because they're fantastic books and wonderful reads and really fascinating and great. The first reason. I guess it's just for me, I'll just say something that Therese said about making decisions and books being about a moral decision. I think one thing people have said after they've read this, that I really want to talk about it. I really want to talk about it. And I think the reason for that is there are, I guess, three characters, I guess, are faced with very difficult dilemmas, which they have to decide what to do, the right thing or the good thing or the more selfish thing. And I think people have this, are eager to think, would that character do it? Would I do it? What, you know, really, what would it be like to be in that position? And so I think when people say that, that's kind of the thing they're getting to. So that, I think, is one reason why it is a book that, you know, is I've been to several book clubs, and that's one thing that people like to sort of get into in discussing.
When I was, this is what my publicist would want me to say. I should have thought of this first. Recently, Barnes & Noble selected Souvenir to be their New Reads Book Club book club choice for the month of May. And in addition to, of course, being flattered and delighted by, you know, that kind of singling out, I had to think, you know, more thoroughly than I may have done in the past about what it was that if I were, and I will be participating in this discussion, you know, what are the talking points here? What are the problems in this book that if I were a part of a book club, I would, you know, find particularly engaging? You know, we started out the story with a rather simple situation where a woman who is already about to marry someone else goes back to see the man that she's actually in love with. The rest of the story is told in three different points of view. It's Meg, and it's Carson, the man she doesn't marry, and it's Meg's teenage daughter. And each of them are in situations where they're presented with problems, or they have gotten themselves into situations in which, you know, the outcomes are uncertain, and what the right choice is in the situation isn't necessarily clear. One of the things that I think book clubs, who are made up mostly of women, I think, but this is true probably for all of us, is, you know, the struggle with the duty to others versus, you know, duty to ourselves. You know, when we're making decisions, we have to take into account, in Meg's case, she takes care of her father because her mother has passed away recently. She's, like most women are, even though she's a professional, she's also in charge of pretty much everything that happens in the domestic sphere in her home. So she's juggling those needs. She's juggling her own needs as a professional. She's juggling her own needs as a middle-aged woman. She's sort of facing down, you know, here I am at this point in life and, you know, struggling with a marriage that isn't really satisfying, struggling with a teenage daughter who, you know, is very independent and being secretive. And then she has to, you know, take her daughter's needs into account, and is she doing that job well? So I think there are a lot of different aspects of this book that will appeal to people and make us say, you know, this is like me. Am I doing the right thing? Without giving, you know, anything away, because there's some things in the book that I'd rather not reveal. But there is a very timely social question that when, I think it was Library Journal reviewed the book, they said, you know, the choices that these characters make may prove to be very controversial for certain readers. And that is the case. And it's a social issue that I think personally needs to be discussed more openly. So without saying what that is, and I'm not being cryptic deliberately, that's sort of the long answer to your question about why I think this would be a good choice for book groups.
I think this book or my first book, Girls Poker Night, either one is a good choice for a book group. I get lots of mail from book groups who've read them, and they seem to appeal to a broad range of a reader, which I think is a good choice for a book club. But I wasn't kidding when I said all three of these books would be great choices. This event is being sponsored by Reading Group Choices, which chose this book last month as their choice. And in the back of this, there is a guide with questions for book clubs, and also there's website information in here. There are additional questions listed on the website for book clubs. These are contemporary characters with contemporary problems. The characters will seem like people you know. And again, hopefully it's the tone I'm always trying to strike is bittersweet, funny. You know, writers that I like of that ilk are Wally Lamb and John Kennedy Toole. And so if you choose it, thank you.
And I also want to just say that all three of the books have great themes. Second chances, I think, in all three of those, missed opportunities, for sure. And the great one of all is love, you know, and you can talk about that love between, you know, man and wife, love between mother and daughter. You can go on forever with that. So all three are very, very good. You guys can talk a little bit about what you're working on now or your novel that is already picked up or whatever?
Well, I'm hoping to do some more journalism, actually, in the short term. Then I have started another novel, which is quite different. This is supposed to be a short, this one was supposed to be short, and take 9 months, and the next one's going to only take 9 months. So we'll see. But anyway, it's a bit different, and I don't want to say much more about it because I didn't, but I've started it.
While I was waiting for Souvenir to be published, I had about a 16-month window in which to start working on my next novel. And I did, and it's completed except for the revisions now, so I'm really right on deadline with my UK publisher and close with Random House. So if you enjoy Souvenir, I hope you'll look for that book, which will be published next February.
I'm also working on another novel now, but I'm extremely superstitious and I never talk about what I'm writing.
Well, thank you very much to Jill, Therese, and James. And if everyone has filled out the form, we will let these three authors draw them out. So anyway, thank you so much for coming. Oh, and there'll be a signing and purchasing of books.